Hello and welcome to the Doorsteps Podcast. I'm Dr. Cody Price and I would like to introduce you all to my guest today, Tim Beat, who is the president of St. Mary's Development Corporation, which is a faith-based nonprofit that has created more than 65 affordable housing projects with more than 4,500 units in 9 states. In addition to real estate development, St. Mary Development Corporation also provides services coordination to its residents, especially seniors, connecting them to healthcare, food, transportation, and other programs. In the past 5 years, St. Mary has saved taxpayers more than $38 million by helping its senior residents age in place and avoid moving into Medicaid nursing homes. Tim serves on many nonprofit boards and committees, including the Widows Home Board, the Leading Age Ohio Affordable Housing Committee, the Montgomery County Affordable Housing Options Committee, and the Miami Valley Long-Term Tornado Recovery Operations Group. He has an MBA from Indiana University, and he has participated in the Achieving Excellence in Community Development Program at the Harvard University Kennedy School of Government. So I want to thank you for coming in today.
It's great to be here.
For starting out, can you kind of tell us a little bit about St. Mary Development Corporation?
St. Mary Development focuses on the social determinants of health, for specifically for seniors. And social determinants of health are the things that impact your health but are outside your control. Things like, is there crime where you live? Do you have access to health care or to a grocery store? Do you have transportation? And we do that specifically by developing affordable housing, especially for seniors, and also through enhanced service coordination, which is case management that connects our residents to those things that combat the social determinants of health.
And so can you kind of give a history of St. Mary's Development Corporation? Like, when and why did it start?
This is actually our 30th anniversary, so we've been around for 30 years. And we were started by two people, Dick McBride and Sister Rose Wildenhouse, who's a religious sister. And they served on a social justice committee together for the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. And they're both people who hated meetings. And this is something where you were just in meetings and you didn't do anything. And they kept saying, we'd rather be out serving the poor rather than just talking about doing it. And Dick McBride played tennis with a Franciscan brother at a seminary in Centerville, Ohio. And they were the seminary didn't have a lot of vocations. It's a huge campus, 240 acres, wow, a big building. And they were looking at selling it to somebody like Procter & Gamble, a big company, as a corporate retreat center. So kind of half-jokingly, Dick and Sister Rose said to them, what if we have $1.36 in our pockets? What if we just pay you that and we'll serve poor seniors here? And the Franciscans kind of laughed, but their charism is that they serve the poor. And they had offers of millions of dollars, but they thought about it and they came back to Dick and Sister Rose and they said, we'll sell it to you for a dollar if you can do 3 things. If you can get it rezoned and give us a business plan and also raise $500,000 in the next 3 months so that we know you have an operating budget. And they did that, and they created the first senior housing project. It wasn't with tax credits or anything. It was just on their own. And it grew very quickly. Today, there's actually 800 seniors that live on the campus. Wow. But it took a healthcare turn where they had a nursing home, and so they turned it over to a healthcare organization. They moved into the city of Dayton, and then they just continued doing housing for seniors and then moved into families too.
Very cool. So what type of services or programs do you guys offer?
In addition to the affordable housing, which is really the heart of what we do, once we develop a property, then we bring in service coordination. And those are case managers that can talk to residents, have one-on-one meetings with them. We do a lot of surveying to find out what are the things that they struggle with. Maybe it's a senior who can't drive anymore or can't afford a car. How are they going to get to the doctor? How do they get to the grocery store? How do they get to visit family members and things like that? And then we connect them, working with about 100 different other nonprofits and government agencies and even for-profit companies in the Dayton area, to the services that they need. So, for instance, a lot of seniors don't know that if they're on Medicaid, their insurer will likely pay for transportation to the doctor. Mm-hmm. But they don't know maybe how do I fill out the form, how do I do that, or they don't know that they qualify for that at all. Right. And so we're able to connect our residents to over $1 million in services a year, which is really significant when you consider something like, well, Meals on Wheels is worth about $1,200 a year. The average income of our residents is only about $12,000 a year. So it's about 10% of their income. Right. So it really stabilizes them. They might not have a big income, but once we connect them to food, utility assistance, transportation, now they're pretty stable. And that's our goal, is to let them age in place as long as possible.
So what really is making St. Mary's unique? I mean, you guys were kind of talking earlier about the social determinants of health Is that one of the things that really makes you unique, or are there other things as well?
That's the primary thing. Even when Dick and Sister Rose started St. Mary's, it wasn't about housing. It was about the quality of your life for seniors. And so that's always been our focus. And we've done that in different ways and tested different things. But what makes us different is that we're really a social determinant of health organization that achieves our goals and our mission and our vision through affordable housing development and the service coordination. There are some organizations that would say, well, we build apartment communities. And that's something that we do, but it's not the ultimate end. And so we do a lot of research about what are changes that will come in the future with technology? How would those impact our seniors? How can we make them more independent? One of the main reasons is that for every month that we keep a senior living independently in one of our buildings, it saves taxpayers $4,500, which is the cost of a month for a Medicaid nursing home. And so that's, you mentioned in the introduction that St. Mary's had saved taxpayers $38 million. That's why. So what's interesting is it's very cost effective for taxpayers, but it also gives seniors what they want. They want to live independently. So it's one of those things where it's both cheaper and higher quality, and we love that.
What are some of the biggest challenges that you guys face as an organization?
Probably the biggest challenge that we face is that while we're very committed to service coordination, there's not funding for it. And so we have to go out and raise money to pay for most of our service coordination. We're trying to change that by talking with insurers to get the insurance companies to pay for the service coordination because it reduces health costs so much. So just as an example, we work with the city of Dayton. We'll get the 911 call reports without all the detail on them, but we'll pull them for our building and we'll be able to see, did Mrs. Smith call 911 three times last month? And we might not know why, but we can at least knock on her door. Is everything okay? Is she doing okay? Is there an issue there? So that's another way. It's saving taxpayers money. But because we're in the buildings, we can have a relationship with the seniors and really improve that quality of life.
And so we're going to be transitioning a little bit to talk about really the main meat of this episode and talking about disasters. So can you first kind of define for our listeners really about the differences between like a disaster and a hazard?
In my mind, I think of a hazard is a nail in the road. And a disaster is when you run over the nail in the road. So a hazard is something that you could identify and remove and to avert a disaster. So with our residents, a hazard might be a throw rug that they might trip on that's in their apartment. If they weren't, all of our apartments have zero step entries, but if they were living in an outside apartment, maybe there are steps that would be a hazard for them because they have mobility issues. So you can identify some of those things, but you can have many different types of disasters. You could have a disaster that just impacts a single individual. As an example, we had a resident who broke her dentures. And because of the way her insurance was, she couldn't get a new pair for 2 years. That was a disaster for her. What do I do without teeth for 2 years? So we had to help her work through that to replace her dentures. You could have a building-wide disaster, like in our Marvin Gardens apartment community, we had a fire. That impacted all of the residents. Or you could even have a community-wide disaster, like the tornadoes that happened over Memorial Day in Dayton. So there's different levels, but just because something happens to one person, to them, it's as traumatic, that disaster is, as a community-wide disaster, especially with seniors. They like the stability, and when something throws that out of whack, it's very disconcerting to them.
Can you kind of talk about the different phases of a disaster that are occurring?
From the tornado standpoint, we probably have the most phases when you have a big community disaster. And that's because oftentimes disaster leaves the media attention. It's not on television or in the newspaper. We think that it's gone. But when you have a community disaster like a tornado, you're dealing with that for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Now, immediately, you're dealing with bringing in water and food and rehousing people and things like that. But when it comes to the long term, rebuilding infrastructure, there was a lot of multifamily apartments that were lost. Right. Well, where do those people go? How do we bring them back? What other things do they need? So it's a lot longer. When you're dealing with a disaster for an individual, you might be able to rectify that much more quickly. The problem with a community-wide disaster that we found was when you have a disaster for an individual or a building, you can call people and assemble a team because they're not experiencing the same disaster. When you have a community-wide disaster, and so now you need a new roof, everybody needs a new roof. Mm-hmm. And so that's a much harder thing because of the wait times and the stress on the whole community and the resources available.
What populations have you found to be almost the most vulnerable during a disaster?
It's clear that regardless of age, the most vulnerable are people with low incomes and the poor. And the reason is they were already right at the edge. For a lot of people, maybe a tornado comes through, but they have insurance to rebuild the house and they have family members to go with, or they can pay for a hotel. So they're going to get by and figure things out. But a lot of people that we provide housing for, they don't have money in the bank. They might not have family or friends to help out with. They can't miss work. And so as an example, when we had the fire last week, we had one resident who she wants to find a new place because it's going to take a while to rebuild her apartment. Well, she doesn't have a car. So if you have to go around all over town looking at apartments with a bus pass, and she didn't have a bus pass, so we got her the bus pass. But for a lot of people, they might have flex time for their job, and they can say, well, I'll take off time. If you don't have those things, it makes everything that much more difficult. Yeah. And with the tornadoes, there was a lot of low-income people who were impacted. And so I think that's the biggest thing. If you're already close to the edge, paycheck to paycheck, then a disaster puts you over the edge. And maybe you lost everything. So now even when you have an apartment, I don't have money for furniture. I don't have all of these things that you and I would take for granted. And that's where there's a lot of people right on that edge. Most people live in affordable housing or at that edge. They don't have renter's insurance. Their incomes are low. For our seniors, their average annual income is about $12,500 a year. So it's not like they have money in the bank to deal with a bump in the road. That's why we raise money. We have a kind of an internal emergency fund. So as an example, the woman that I mentioned that lost her dentures, mm-hmm. we just paid for them. We said it was $400. We said, you're not going 2 years without teeth, but we raised money for that. Then she was fine. Disaster averted. She's good for, you know, maybe for the rest of her life in our apartments, but sometimes it's a very small amount of money. But if you don't have that money, you're really in deep trouble.
So kind of looking at Ohio and looking at the disasters that's kind of occurring. So over the last 10 years, all 88 counties in Ohio have been affected by disasters, including severe storms, flooding, and tornadoes. What specific disasters has your organization dealt with over the years?
We've been lucky. We haven't had too many, but we did have about 10 years ago, we had 144-unit senior property that was struck by lightning. So there was a fire, but usually when you have a fire, the biggest thing is water damage. Because when the fire department comes in, it was on the top floor because the roof was hit. And so we had to relocate residents while we did the work. Sometimes those residents lost medications and other things. And so we kind of had to do the wraparound services. And then last week we had a fire in a 25-unit building that had some seniors and some younger people in it. While our buildings weren't directly affected by the tornadoes, we've been part of looking at the recovery process because a lot of multifamily units were impacted. About half of the residents who were impacted lived in apartments, and it was hardest on them. When the roof is ripped off an apartment, like with 400 units, where do those people go? They disperse. Hopefully they can fend for themselves. But we're trying to figure out better ways as a community to create those wraparound services so we can reach out to people quickly and get them resettled, because nobody wants to lose them. And towns like Trotwood, they're very worried now. The census is coming up. Mm-hmm. Well, now do they get less funding for other things because people have moved out because of a disaster? So now it's kind of a double whammy.
You just said that your organization has dealt with numerous types of disasters that's occurred with it. So what have you really done to prepare for these disasters that may be, hopefully not, but may occur in the future?
The biggest thing is to know who your partners are. And so we talk a lot we're not emergency responders. We're not police and fire and things like that. So we talk to those people to find out what's the best thing to, when we have an emergency, how do you handle it? Because we want fire to come in and deal with a fire. Or afterwards, it's knowing who your partners are. So for instance, in our properties, our senior properties, even though it's independent living, about 15% of the residents are previously homeless. Mm. It didn't used to be that way, but these are hard times. There's a lot of homeless seniors. So when they move in, sometimes they have a fixed income. They have Social Security, so they can pay rent. But we realize they're sleeping on the floor with a blanket, and they have nothing else. Through partnerships like with St. Vincent de Paul, we created a partnership a long time ago where we send any furniture donations we get to them, and we have an issue within 48 hours, they'll furnish the entire apartment. Oh. And we pay for it. It's about $500. But that includes pots and pans, linens, a bed, a television, everything that they have. Then we will bring in Meals on Wheels and other things so we can stabilize that that person. So being able to stabilize somebody is really key. And seniors are such a, you know, they're already frail often. They're dealing with a lot of health and other issues. And so what we want to do is be able to bring them in and wrap the services around so that we can get them to the point that they are stable again. And certainly sleeping on the floor with a blanket and not eating well is not, when you look at like the social determinants of health,
right.
That's really a big issue, and it's a lot less expensive to provide the services up front. Plus, it's good for the senior who wants to be sleeping on the floor.
Right. No, I totally agree. So what advice would you really give to communities and other organizations that would help them be better prepared for disasters?
The best thing that has come out of the Dayton tornadoes is we've created an emergency kind of operations group of a whole bunch of different nonprofits that some of us worked together before, not all of us, including like Catholic Social Services, St. Vincent de Paul, church groups. We have local and city and county government at the table. But to create like centralized case management, because what we realized was that a lot of organizations do similar work. Mm-hmm. So you don't want four people delivering meals to the same family.
Right.
And so there's been a coordination that's come through the tornado process that my hope is we continue on to the next disaster. And I don't mean the next tornado. What I mean is when we're through most of this is to sit down at the table with that same group and say, how do we deal with food insecurity or transportation? And not does your organization deal with it. As a community, how do we deal with this? How do we tackle this in the same way? And that's where I think we're going to see some real blessings come out of this, where it was only the disaster that forced us to work together so closely. Mm-hmm. But now that we are, what other things can we accomplish now that we know who the partners with? And some of the partners were people that with the tornado we never would have thought of. For instance, the University of Dayton provided temporary housing. Because they had housing. Well, that's not the business they're in,
right.
But they're great community partners. And it was during the summer, and they said, yeah, come on in. We can house people in our apartments that we have. Sinclair Community College came in and said, we can do volunteer management. And they had staff that had expertise in project management. And so we're working with partners that we didn't work with in the same way. And so when we look at what the next issue is, we now have a team that we can really accomplish something big.
So really rebuilding after a disaster can be extremely expensive for homeowners and businesses alike. It's estimated that Ohio homeowners spent nearly $437 million in disaster repairs from 2013 to 2015. So given these high costs, what resources, whether this be federal, state, or local, have you found to be most helpful for getting the necessary disaster recovery funds?
Well, that's a good question. It depends so much on the individual and what resources they have. So one of the things that became apparent is there were a lot of single family homeowners that didn't have a mortgage on the home. They had inherited the home. They were living in it. Everything was okay, but they were underinsured and they didn't have income to make the repairs. So they had an asset that was fine as long as it wasn't damaged. But if you have an old house and you have to put on a new roof now, and maybe your insurance didn't cover it, or you weren't insured at all, now you're in deep trouble. And so one of the things that we found is that there are a lot of organizations, when you have a big disaster, that can come in and provide some funding. FEMA, for instance, will come in very quickly and can provide some, assuming that it's been declared a city disaster and a state disaster and then a federal disaster. That's what it takes for FEMA. But there's some money that could come in that way. The federal home loan banks, we found, they have money that they'll put in for to help somebody rebuild a home as well. And then there's donations that come in. So there might be donations of goods, drywall, shingles, and things like that, as well as volunteer labor. There's some great organizations that will come and provide volunteer labor. The key to all of this is not the money, it's the project management. That's what's difficult, is you have all these different sources and which ones conflicts. And so, for instance, FEMA will provide funding to you as long as you were not insured. If you have insurance, they say, well, let your insurance take care of that, which only makes sense. So it's not just one size fits all. You really have to evaluate every situation and then see what can the community bring to the table. It's just very complicated and a lot of paperwork. And that's why you have to have a committee and a group to be able to work through that, because otherwise you would give up. And you want to encourage people to apply, but it's hard. As an example for FEMA, if you could get a low interest loan to rebuild your house, but the loan program actually comes through the Small Business Administration. So people would get a letter in the mail from the Small Business Administration. They would say, well, there must be a mistake. I'm not, they think I'm a business, but I'm not. That's just how the program works. And so we would have to communicate, no, the letter was for you. This is for a home. That's just the way the federal government implements that program. So it's a lot of help is needed to help navigate people through the different funding sources and see what they qualify for and what they don't qualify for.
So we've been talking a lot about like the tornadoes that happened this past May in Dayton, and that they really damaged more than 1,800 structures and left nearly 65,000 homes and businesses temporarily without power. Were your housing projects or residents really affected by these tornadoes at all? And if so, what processes did your organizations use to begin recovery?
So in our case, our properties were not impacted except that some of them lost power and water. Okay. Now, that's a big deal for some seniors, because if you have mobility issues and you can't take the elevator, and so we would bring in water, but we've dealt in the past just through thunderstorms and things with both power outages and water, so that's kind of easier. But some of the things that we learned, and OFA is such a great partner on these, we learned through OFA things that we could do to help other displaced people. So two things that we found is, you can move people to the top of your wait list. If you have a wait list of a year long, but somebody's been impacted and they're homeless because of our tornado, you can move them to the top of the wait list. So that's a great thing. But one of the other rules that we didn't know about before the tornadoes was you can actually move somebody into your property that is over income for up to a year. Only around when there's been a federal disaster. So it's a small rule, but that's a big deal. So right. If somebody had vacancies, so some of the things that we started to look at were how could we use our properties, and we didn't have many vacancies, but we were able to move a couple affected people into our units. We have two local projects that are under construction. We wish they had been closer, because if they were only like a month away from being finished, then we would have reached out and said, let's look at all the displaced families and give a priority to seniors for the senior building that were displaced and for the family building. And that would have been a great thing. And that rule for being able to move in if you're over income, you can move into any other affordable property. It can be anywhere. Somebody could decide, I want to move to the other side of the state. So, and the amazing thing was, when we put in our first request for that, I think OFA approved it within about 90 minutes. I mean, it was super quick, because OFA's always been a partner in putting the residents first. And that's why it's always important to have such great partners.
So what would you say were the biggest challenges that Dayton kind of faced during this disaster?
The biggest problem, and it sounds kind of minor, was with renters and just getting in touch with them. Because they weren't all affordable properties, and so sometimes the landlord was out of state. A lot of people with lower incomes have burner phones, so that maybe they gave a phone number, but that phone number doesn't work. And so some cases they lost everything. They didn't have insurance, so they said, well, I'm going to go move in with so-and-so. Well, we don't know that. And so one of the things we want to do for the future, and we already do this for our properties, is but figure out a way to extend the number of emergency contacts and things so we could hopefully locate more of those people to make sure that they're okay. In some cases, we just heard stories. Somebody, like there was one senior who said, I was planning on moving back eventually to Atlanta to be with my daughter. And so she just said, I'm just going now. My home was destroyed, or my apartment. But it's easier with a homeowner, because they're going to come back to the asset usually, to fix it up or something. But renters can be much more transient. So I think we need to do a better job of how do we keep in touch with them after a disaster, and to do the outreach. So not being able to do the outreach meant sometimes they weren't able to qualify for all the benefits they deserved, because we couldn't communicate with them as easily.
So what are you really finding to be the most important part of the disaster recovery process?
To me, the most important thing are the partners. When you're dealing with somebody who's been through this level of trauma, they're going to have multiple issues. It's not just housing. It might be food. It might be transportation to work. Even and maybe especially the emotional and spiritual care that goes along with that. This has been, it's devastating. If you have ever been with somebody who has lost everything, I don't just mean things of monetary value, but they've lost their memories, their photos, and everything that goes along with that. It's very traumatic, and maybe not having any idea, where will I go tonight? Where will I go next week? I have no money in the bank. They've really gone from being near the edge, but in a sustainable place, to being destitute. And that's, it's heartbreaking. But you can only solve all of those needs if you have a lot of partners. That's why when we do service coordination, we work with 100 other organizations, because at one point we tried to do direct services ourselves. But what we quickly realized was you can't be an expert in everything. Right. But you can know who the experts are, mm-hmm. how their programs work, and talk to them. And so I think the best way to prepare is to talk to the emergency organizations and other organizations, get to know them, meet with them, talk to them about the services. And we knew a lot of those people anyway, so it was easier for us. If a developer didn't have service coordination in the building, they'd be hard-pressed. That's a hard thing to figure out. We just have a lot of knowledge, and that's why we put our time and resources into service coordination, because whether it's in a non-emergency time or an emergency time, it's what can really hold those residents together.
And so do you think that's really changed your mind or really rethinking your current processes to make your organization more resilient in the future? Like already having these organizations set up, you know who to talk to. Is that really setting you up for the future, for any future disasters, like using this list of organizations?
We've always had the list. Our next step is to get together a group of people, not just in affordable properties, but in all multifamily, especially kind of the lower end, the naturally occurring affordable housing, and to put together a plan so that if any multifamily has a disaster, a fire or something like that, we could quickly call together a team, each of whom has certain expertise. The Red Cross does, you know, will do something, but maybe those residents have Section 8 vouchers, and so mm-hmm. the Red Cross doesn't deal with that. And how do we bring together that team to do the case management immediately to get those people into a safe place and to be able to work with them so that they can make the best decision about where they go to next? And in many cases, we might be able to help them find that new housing. How do they get moved in and bring the resources around it? So that's really kind of what the next goal is. We've been able to do that organically, but because of the tornado, we think we can put together the processes and systems we need to put that so that when anybody faces that, we would be glad at St. Mary's, for instance, if a for-profit owner had a disaster, we'd send in our service coordinators to help for a week to do case management, to help residents through those things. So as a community, we can solve what those issues are and get the people back on their feet as quickly as possible.
What has the community of Dayton really learned, and how do you think that it will adapt to also be more resilient to disasters in the future?
Boy, this year has been so tough for disasters. You know, we had not only the tornado, we had the shooting this year, and we also had earlier this year the KKK marched in Dayton. So it was a year of trauma and things. I think what we found is we're very strong and resilient, and that we're willing to work in ways that even FEMA said it's very unusual the way the community has come together. So while you hate to see anybody go through a disaster and the trauma, real good things are coming out of it. There's different systems being willing to talk about bigger issues. And I think with something as big as the tornadoes, it's given us confidence to say, what are we going to tackle next? You know, in the past, somebody might have said, well, food insecurity, how would you deal with that? Well, is that as bad as a tornado? You know, we could figure out who are the partners and the for-profit companies and how do we deal with that as a community. And I'm confident we're going to be able to do that in a bigger way. So you hate to see things like disasters happen, but it does make you realize how strong you are and how capable your community is.
Yeah, it's really that old saying that it's just like you become closer once you experience trauma together, that it's just like it's what really brings a community together and the people together and find out who everyone really is.
Well, so often today, you know, there's all these divides, political divides or religious divides and things. When a disaster happens to all of you, right, now you have this shared experience. Hey, we're all in this together. And that's a beautiful thing to see everybody come together. And it's sad that it takes a disaster for that to happen. But my hope is that we never look back. You know, when we had the shooting, what a beautiful thing to see the community come together and grieve together in that case. I mean, it was a horrific thing to happen, but it was also beautiful to see the love that was shown and that came out was, you know, it just brought tears to your eyes to see us go through that. But it does, it makes it stronger for when the next thing comes. And it makes people, I think, more likely to reach out, you know, give somebody a hug and to reach out when somebody's in need. And that's a wonderful thing.
So after everything that we've really discussed today, what are the major takeaways that you wish everybody would know?
I guess there's a couple of things I can think about. One is that in most communities, your multifamily housing is often kind of ignored or invisible to a community, but it plays a critical, critical role, whether it's affordable or on the market rate side. And oftentimes those people are very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I think to kind of appreciate that and look at resources. And then the other thing is the importance of strategic partnerships and yeah. knowing who provides what services ahead of time. It's great to have an action plan, who you call about different things. But in a way, the physical issues, the building repair, that's the easy thing. The people repair and the trauma, and how do we walk with people through that? That's why, as a faith-based organization, that's why we do what we do. It's not about the building. It's about the people and how do we love them and how do we wrap the services around them. And it really does take a community worth of services to wrap around to get those people back on their feet.
So finally, if you could have everybody read one book, what would it be and why?
I think one of the best books I've read, and it was recent, is Talking with Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell. Mm. And what I love about it, there's a lot of case studies in there. It's all about how little we know about each other and how when we talk to somebody, we often read them incorrectly. We assume that something, we're offended by something where offense wasn't meant. And it was just very eye-opening to me. One of the best things about the book is it said we're wired for good, that we like to believe the best of other people. And that's a good thing. And it's also our downfall sometimes.
Yeah.
But it gave me some new hope in humanity when you think we're wired to believe that other people are going to do good things. And I think as, for the most part, that's true. And as we talk to different partners and work with people, it's one of the great things about our work is we have partners like OFA and others who have the same mission. It's just different mm-hmm. work and we work together and we do good things.
No, that's great. Well, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today.
It's been great to be here.
To my listeners, please be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to the Doorsteps podcast so that you don't miss any updates about housing issues in Ohio. You can also follow the podcast and other research that the Office of Housing Policy at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency does by following our Twitter account at Ohio Doorsteps. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Cody Price, and this is Doorsteps.